Do you have a young athlete or young active person in your life? Are you a parent, a guardian, coach? Maybe you work with young active individuals. If so, this is the episode you do not want to miss. Welcome back to the Inside Sports Nutrition Podcast, your source for all things sports nutrition related. This show is hosted by myself, Dina Griffin, and my co-host, Bob Sebahar. We are both registered dietitians and board certified specialists in sports dietetics with combined professional experience exceeding 40 years. We are here to translate nutrition and sports science research to real life and give you some awesome interviews with a variety of experts so you can enhance your knowledge to optimize your health, fitness, and athletic performance. On today's episode, we have with us Jane Reagan, who is a registered dietitian. She is a certified eating disorder specialist. She actually has a ton of certifications. She is joining us today to talk about eating disorders in youth, a very, very important topic. Now, Jane is going to talk about misconceptions and myths about eating disorders. She is going to talk about the ways in which parents may unintentionally teach disordered eating. She provides numerous tips for parents and coaches of young, active, or athletic individuals for navigating awareness and how to have conversations. Also, Jane is an incredible resource. She has a brand new program. It's an 8-week program for parents that you'll want to check out if any of this is connecting with you. So we'll have all the links to Jane's practice and her program in our show notes. You're going to get a lot out of this episode. We're so glad you are here today. And right before we get to the show, just want to mention, if you are enjoying our podcast, if you could please give us a 5-star rating over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, that helps us grow. And if you are so inclined to please leave a positive review on Apple Podcasts, that is most appreciated. All right, let's get to episode 118. All right, today we are joined by a very special guest, and Bob, also someone local to us, a peer, a colleague, super amazing woman and a dietitian professional. I feel extremely honored today to have Jane Reagan with us. Welcome to our show. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We are great, and we are so looking forward to this conversation with you today, addressing very important topics here related to awareness of eating disorders in youth or disordered eating in youth athletes, young individuals, and information for our parents and guardians, maybe coaches that are listening. Wanted to just start this conversation, though, learning a little bit more about you and your background, like how you got even into the field of dietetics and becoming a registered dietitian. And even with this one of these specialties here being with eating disorders, how you kind of navigated your way to that specialty.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it was a little bit of a windy road, but I started out, my undergraduate degree was a health science degree, kind of a pre-med degree. And I loved equally psychology and the health sciences. And so after I got out of undergraduate school, I then went on to graduate school, and I was trying to decide if I would go into nutrition or counseling. I ended up going into counseling. For a year while I did my graduate program, I worked at an inpatient eating disorders hospital, but on the counseling side. And I kind of learned through that year that I really liked the nutrition side a bit more, but I equally saw the value in counseling and understanding the underpinnings, right, of eating disorders, because it's not about food, as some people may think. After I finished my graduate degree, I was out in Boston, and I decided to kind of take a different turn for a little while and worked in higher education and travel education, and eventually moved back to Colorado, where I really realized I had to go after my true passion, which was nutrition and psychology equally. So I went back then. I had my children. I went back after they were born to get my RD and did it slowly because I had little children. And my goal was always to combine my information, my education on nutrition with counseling psychology. And that's kind of my favorite intersection between nutrition and mental health.
So amazing, Jane. I feel like all of us dietitians need that second degree in either counseling or some sort of psychology. There's a lot that goes into it. It's almost like any aspect of nutrition guidance. There's a lot of mental and that psychological side.
There's so much behavior change, right? And, someone doesn't have to have a degree in counseling in order to be a good counselor. They can also be really good at active listening. It's amazing the power that active listening has on your client, and just being heard, being understood, right? That, like, sometimes they've never talked to people about the issues that they're struggling with, and just having a sounding board can do amazing things towards healing. That intersection between those two fields, between the health field and the counseling field, are so important. And I see so often where mood is impacted, I'm sure you guys too, by nutrition, by meal timing, by different macronutrients. I think for me, that field of eating disorders just was a natural coming together. And I worked at CU at their health center for 10 years and helped start their eating disorders team. And we saw like a ton of eating disorders up there. And so it just, for me, naturally came about that this came to be a specialty that I developed and then got a certification as an eating disorder specialist and an intuitive eating counselor, and just kind of worked along those lines. And I still do work with other nutrition issues, like gut issues, and but I see probably 70% of clients with eating disorders.
Okay. Well, maybe we can segue to that now as we're starting to just, bring awareness for those who need or want more information, or it's actually just bringing to light some of the things that we may take for granted, misconceptions and so on. I wondered, before we talk specifically in the context of parents and their children or others that they may be caring for, just setting the stage here about some things related to eating disorders. I wondered if you could share a few things that come to mind as far as misunderstandings about eating disorders, myths, and so on that you have to address or think are important to address.
Yeah, absolutely. There are definitely some myths out there, especially with our strong diet culture. One of them is that people with eating disorders look unhealthy. And the truth is only, 6% of those with eating disorders are underweight. So when you think about that, that's a very low percentage. There's a lot of people out there walking around with all sorts of eating disorder thoughts and behaviors that may look normal to you and I. And so, eating disorders come in all shapes and sizes. They do not discriminate. Men, women, transgender, right? Young people, older people, right? Single, married. It doesn't matter, right? It does not discriminate. And so it's really important for those of us who are providers or parents or friends to look beyond the surface of somebody and know that there can be a lot going on there that they don't share with us. In fact, there's something called atypical anorexia. We think of anorexia as someone who's very, very thin, but there's many people who have kind of this atypical anorexia where they might be a normal weight, but they have all the behaviors, all the thoughts, but they are overlooked. And so then they're also invalidated, right? Like, providers don't think that this is an issue, and so they don't take it seriously. So again, don't go on the look of what someone appears to you. Another myth that's common is that eating disorders are a choice. And eating disorders are not a choice. No one I know purposefully, continuously starves themselves or purges their food or eats huge amounts of food, right, until they're uncomfortable, right, just because they want to. There's some underlying thing going on, right? And it's more of a coping mechanism to deal with fears, things that they've been through, traumas, depression, anxiety, pressures in our society. And so, you know, even parents may say to me at times, well, I think my child is just doing this because they want attention. And that's not the case. And that's true for coaches to know too, right? Like, this is not a choice. And eating disorders are not caused by one thing. It's a variety of contributing factors, which we can talk about too. Another myth is that eating disorders are just about food. So it's kind of interesting that it is about food and it's not about food, right? Like, it is about this obsession or compulsion with calories or macros or weight or shape. And so that is a part of these disorders, but it's about so much more, right? Like, when we peel away the layers, and what I see after being in this field for so many years, that kind of that foundational, that root cause is often that people don't feel like they're good enough, like they're enough at whatever they're doing, whether it's sports, school, being a mom, a dad, you know, that they're somehow inherently flawed, and there's a lot of comparisons that go on. And so when a parent or provider or friend says, just eat more, just eat less, just eat healthier, it's not really very helpful, because it's not about the food. And if anything, it will make them try to do that even more. Okay, fine, I'll just eat less. Okay, fine, I'll just eat healthier and become more obsessed with it. And so they're kind of missing the boat on it. Right. Another myth that I'll hear from providers or parents is that eating disorders are kind of an adolescent phase, because so many adolescents have eating disorders and it will just go away on its own, right? And so there's this layer of denial that can kick in for people. And even parents that are aware, may be watching thinking, well, okay, my child is kind of dieting and exercising a lot, and isn't that healthy? And, well, should I be concerned, and not really know the underpinnings of what's going on? But I don't think I've ever seen where eating disorders just go away on their own. And what research will show is that early intervention is absolutely key to cutting it off an eating disorder, or helping someone move towards recovery or recovery in a quicker fashion. So the more that we can all learn about eating disorders, understand them, be educated. I mean, that's what I try to do so much with parents, is help them to learn, observe their child, encourage their child, support their child, right? Like, we can't force anyone to eat. We can't tie them down and shove food into them, right? That's not possible. And so what do we do as a provider and as a parent, as a friend? You know, it's really about listening and observing and kind of becoming an ally with them. And that's a lot of what I teach parents, especially in my parent program.
You know, Jane, just in all your years focusing on this area, I was just thinking of like social media and like increased pressures with our society and just all of that. Just is the prevalence more now, would you say, or can you comment at all on incidence or prevalence in youth?
Yes, I would say that there are many, many people that go underdiagnosed. After the pandemic, I see it only being worse. There's research out there on how it's increased after the pandemic. You know, there is no one cause of an eating disorder. Like, friends don't cause eating disorders. Parents don't cause eating disorders. But they can significantly, parents especially, help their child, either negatively or positively, move towards recovery. And you were talking a little bit about contributing factors. Because there is no one cause, we can't just take a blood test and say, yep, you have an eating disorder. You know, it's complex. And I think that's one of the reasons I also like working in this field, is it's multifactorial, right? Like, there's genetics that contribute to eating disorders. There's diet culture and weight stigma. There's social media, for sure. And I'm sure both of you guys are witness to this, inaccurate nutrition information that's out there that people follow and really get themselves in trouble. There's personality and temperament traits. There's traumatic events, you know, big changes in somebody's life. We see that as a, you know, a instigating factor. Peer pressure, sports, you know, family dynamics, like all these different contributing factors. So really understanding what is it that is influencing, let's say, your child or your friend, so we can learn how to target their recovery more effectively. Like, I had a dad in his daughter in my office, and he really thought it was social media that was impacting her. Mm-hmm. And after our discussion, you know, he emailed me later that night and he said, "Oh my gosh, I thought it was social media, but what I realized, it's her friends." Because I didn't realize how much her friends were impacting her. And then I got an email a couple months later that he had moved his daughter to a different school and how much better it was going for her. So we can't always assume what we think is impacting someone who's developed or developing an eating disorder.
That's really interesting that you brought that up. Just, you know, just the movement of school or situation or location, right? I wonder, let me put my parent hat on really quick. Let me just change from my dietitian hat really quick. So the influence, you've talked about the influences that our young people have in their lives. Obviously, right. That starts with their parents because, you know, we bring them into this world. So let's, for the parents out there listening, let's go down this path, if you don't mind, really quick. Yeah. Or it's probably not going to be really quick. But obviously, it's a very sensitive subject with some parents and with some young ones. And, you know, as a father myself, it's, you know, I was hyper aware because obviously I am a dietitian. So when my kiddos were grown up, I was just hyper aware of behaviors, right? There was never pressure around food. There was never pressure around the whole, I mean, I grew up in a very kind of laissez-faire, like, hey, if you didn't finish the food on your plate, no big deal, right? And that's kind of what has come with me and my parenting style. But I know there are different parenting styles, different pressures, even with parents, how they grew up and maybe were intentionally or unintentionally taught or received those messages. Okay, so Jane, let's kind of focus on parents now and kind of get back into that realm with our young athletes, with our young individuals, and kind of what parents can and can do to kind of support them. But to start with, let's kind of pave the way. What are some ways that parents may unintentionally teach these behaviors surrounding eating disorders?
Yep. It's a great, great question. And first I would say for those parents listening that have a child with an eating disorder that parents do not cause eating disorders. We know that through research. And so I don't want parents to take on that guilt that somehow they've caused this because there are many contributing factors. However, parents can influence their child positively or negatively around food and exercise and diet. And so there are ways that I've seen where parents can unintentionally teach some disordered eating that can then be problematic for their child. So one of the ways is when parents follow strict diets themselves. And, you know, there's a difference between having to stay away from a food because someone has celiac or someone has a food allergy, right? Versus trying all sorts of different diets potentially to lose weight. You'll have parents who try different diets to improve their health. But there is this ultra focus on food and getting the food just right. And that can contribute to how their child feels about food. Like we know as parents, and I'm a parent, your child watches you, right? They absorb things, even if you're not saying anything. You know, this is where actions speak louder than words. And so parents also that label food as good or bad. And this is tricky because in our society, there's all sorts of things out there like eat this food, don't eat this food. This is good. This is bad. And it like says that there's a moral judgment around food. And so let's say, you know, grains are bad or, you know, eat lots of fat or whatever it is, then this child can go out into the world. And let's say their friends are eating junk food or grains and they might feel conflicted. Like here at home, I'm not supposed to eat this. I'm not supposed to eat sugar. Now, okay, my friends are eating sugar, but I really want sugar. What should I do? And then if I have it, sometimes then they have a lot of it because I know I'm not supposed to have it. There was a family that I know where the mom would not allow any sugar at all. And this was the kid who went to birthday parties and had 5 pieces of cake. Right. Because
totally.
The more extreme we get, right, the more the pendulum has to go to the other side to kind of create this balance. So when parents go to extremes, and I see this often where they don't allow, like right now, I have a 14-year-old that is a gluten-free, soy-free, nut-free vegan.
Mm.
So try to think what she's eating.
Oh my gosh. Uh-huh.
That was my first thought.
Yeah. Right. What is she eating? Right. And so there's a combination of like anorexia with some texture and food issues, and it gets very complicated. But the root of it was going back to like, don't eat sugar, don't eat this, don't eat that. And the parents are trying to give their child the best, most accurate information. You know, as parents, we all want the best for our child and we want them to be healthy and feel vitality and, you know, feel good in their life. And so we're giving them this information, but I think we have to be careful at how extreme we get because it sets up a lot of diet rules, lists of good food, bad food. And those diet rules can just perpetuate in somebody's head. And even though you're looking at your child and you think they're doing their homework or talking to their friends, they're actually thinking of what they're going to have at their next meal or what they had that was bad at their last meal and how they have to make up for it, you know, coming up. And so other ways that parents can sometimes unintentionally teach disordered eating is warning their kids about getting fat or gaining weight. Like, don't eat that. You're going to gain weight. It goes down to that good food, bad food, right? Like we know, and you guys know this too, that there's no one food that causes weight loss or weight gain, right? It's a pattern of eating. And if we start identifying single foods as this is the bad food, this is the good food, we can get in trouble. And other things that parents I see do when they are complaining about how much they've eaten, right? Like, or they need to wear it off in some way. Like, I've eaten so much for dinner, I'm going to make sure I go for a longer run tomorrow. Right? Like somehow they've got to make amends for what they did. And sometimes it's not even that much food. It might be that it's a different food than that they would normally eat. Right? Like some people don't eat bread. Some people don't eat a dessert, right? And they have it at dinner. And now all of a sudden, they've really got to hone in on, you know, exercising more or being more strict the next morning, or I'm going to skip breakfast. And so all of this stuff, our kids are watching. And so I think we just have to really be careful, even in an emphasis on exercise, something that's so healthy, right? That exercising, even when a parent is injured, right? Even when it's 10 degrees below zero, even when they're tired, even, you know, like, I think as parents, for us to be an example to our kids, to show them how to take care of our bodies, how to listen, how to have compassion, right? And gentleness towards ourselves, because our society, you know, we can be very perfectionistic with high expectations and our kids feel that every day. And anxiety and depression have increased in college campuses. Like I saw that so much when I worked at the university.
That's been changing quite a bit, just to kind of go with that. That's amazing. Like the past few years, how much I've seen that change also. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. I mean, childhood is not like it was when we were kids, right? Yep. There's some things that are similar for sure, yep. But there's things that are really different. And we have to be there, you know, for our kids to help them through this. And if we don't understand it, to at least connect with our child to get their point of view on what's going on and what they're feeling anxious about. And all the comparisons that are out there, that really plagues a lot of kids. Yeah. And social media feeds right into that. And I'm sure you guys see it. And so there is this environment that is just ripe for eating disorders. And I think that's why we see it increasing. And when you look at like, what is the diagnosis for anorexia, you know, it's a restriction of energy intake that is less than what they normally have, which is a little vague, but it's also this intense fear of gaining weight. And so, and this disturbance in the way in which they see their body. And so when I think about that, I think, wow, that's almost most of the adolescents, right? That I know, like there's this for sure. Intense fear. Yeah. In our society and pressure to be a certain way, to look a certain way. And I try to tell kids that like, this also changes through the decades. Like they haven't been alive long enough to see that, you know, the body type that was emulated in the 90s is different than 2000, is different than 2020. And it changes through time. And they are so caught up in that moment and it's just kind of live or die sometimes. And if you add on a predisposition for OCD, right? Anxiety, compulsiveness, then those diet rules and thoughts like take hold, right? There are some people that can go on a diet and they go off of a diet and they kind of continue with their life. There are some people that go on a diet and they go down the rabbit hole and they are just in the grips of an eating disorder. And we do know that the number one contributing factor to an eating disorder is dieting. So if we see that such a large percentage of our population is dieting, right, like then we should be concerned that this puts them at risk for developing an eating disorder. And you'll see, you know, providers too that don't know enough about eating disorders. Like someone will come in with a higher BMI that puts them maybe at overweight or obese, and they'll tell them they need to lose weight, but their body composition is normal. I mean, you guys see this, right? With muscle weighing more than fat. And so our environment is such an important factor in eating disorders. And they've done research where the highest rates of eating disorders are in developed countries, right? Not in underdeveloped countries. And, you know, when someone in an underdeveloped country is starving, they can't wait to get food, right? Like they want to be full. With an eating disorder, it's the opposite. They feel better, prouder, like they've accomplished something when they're starving.
Yeah, right? For sure.
When they have an eating, it gets completely changed around.
Yeah. It's, oh, man, this, as you've been talking about this, Jan, like, oh my gosh, this is resonating so much because, you know, as you, I can't even tell you how many times parents have asked me, so what foods are good? What foods are bad? And it's like, okay, so we're going to back up a little bit because we need to teach that whole good versus bad food. And really in turn, like the way I teach it is, you know, let's look at medical concerns, right? Obviously, as you mentioned, if there's celiac disease or some allergy, obviously a food is going to not really be the greatest for someone's body, but yeah, not, you know, trying to get away from that good or bad food. And even, you know, usually the second question I have when I work with parents is first, it's the whole good and bad food. So then we go down that route and we educate. And then it's the, well, what do you feed your kids? What's in your refrigerator? What's in your pantry? And I have always like worn this as a badge of honor and say, well, I would, you know, I'll take photos or you can come over, like whatever, because we have chips and we have crackers and we have Goldfish and we have this. And they're like, if you see that their jaw drops to the ground and they're like, why does it, and you can just tell what's going through their mind. And I've had this question, like, why does a dietitian feed their kids this kind of food? And for me, it is, it's teaching that whole variety. It's teaching not food shaming. It's just teaching, I don't like to use the word balance, but it's teaching that, you know, foods are very part of our life and different types of food. So I do believe it starts with parents. And again, what we do, even just the simple things of going to the grocery store and bringing food home, can really shape our kids' lives. And, you know, I've always been about having those conversations with my kids at a young age. And, you know, because I've had, you know, my kiddos have always, would they be like, well, is that food good? And I would say, well, what defines good? What does good mean in your mind right now? Right? Because then you have that conversation. And I guess through telling a story, I'm hopefully helping some of the parents out there that, you know, stimulate these discussions with your kids. I think that's really important. And, you know, I do hear you on the whole, you know, I think adults do tend to go down the route of, oh, I ate blank blank, so I'm going to run an extra 20 minutes today. And, you know, we just need to be aware of that sometimes. And maybe that's, you know, maybe we keep some things in our head sometimes and, you know, we don't verbalize those things.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I really resonate with you about like creating some wiggle room. I coach people on that all the time. Right. The more perfectionistic and extreme you get, the worse your relationship with food will be. You have to create wiggle room and you have to create some eating just because it tastes good. Right. We don't have to always know the macronutrient distribution and like all the ingredients. And there is a whole other part of food. Like I see nutrition as two buckets. Like one is the bucket of, you know, calories, fiber, carbohydrates, proteins, fats, all of that, like the nutrition science. And then there's the psychology of eating, right? Which is the enjoyment, which is like the connecting with others over food, you know, over a cup of tea, over, right? And if we have the whole nutrition part dialed in, but we don't have the psychology of nutrition where it should be, it becomes really problematic. If we start depriving ourselves all the time, nobody likes to be deprived. And when we get really deprived, then we want more of that food. So if we don't ever let ourselves have pizza, You know, when we're at a weak moment, we're tired, we're going to have the entire huge extra large pizza. And so making sure that someone doesn't deprive themselves is really so important in that psychology of eating, eating for satisfaction, mm-hmm. right? Eating just because we love it. And people will say to me like, oh, you should never have fast food. You should never have sugar. You should never have whatever it is. I would say there are no foods off limits unless someone has a true food allergy or some right. significant medical condition. And I've had people where, you know, in their eating disorder, they bring food over to one client of mine to her boyfriend's house because she mm-hmm. wouldn't trust the mom that was this amazing Italian cook. And now that she's recovered, she's like, oh, I can't believe I used to do that. Yeah. You know, that I bring food over there because there's so much rigidity. So often I'm working on creating that flexibility, not so much that black and white thinking that we see as one of the big cognitive distortions and eating disorders, but that a lot more gray, a lot more just for sure. allowing, right? Or it's not all about food, right? It's about so much more that's underneath this of, well, am I okay if I eat this?
Yeah, it's so true. And, you know, I feel like, and I would assume that you would agree here, we all have food challenges, all of us, right? It's just like at different levels, at different times in our lives, right? Before we go on, because I know there's always been some question of, if you can just kind of detail this for our parents out there that are listening, can you just give us like a quick, you know, overview, disordered eating versus eating disorders versus orthorexia, because there's yeah. a lot of terms being yes. thrown out. And I feel like parents just kind of lump it into one bucket. Talk to us a little bit so parents understand this.
Right. So there are the actual eating disorders that are in the DSM-5 diagnostic manual are anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. There's also one called ARFID, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. That's a little bit different in that it's more about taste and textures and past experiences and no desire to be thin. Where the ones that we're talking about, anorexia, bulimia, compulsive overeating, binge eating, have this desire to be thin that is really, you know, such a big part of it. And so when that spectrum you're talking about between, you know, normal eating, kind of disordered eating, eating disorders, it is a spectrum. And people can kind of go in and out of it. And I think it's just so important, like as a parent, to be mindful, watchful, right, of kind of how our kids are eating, if they're skipping meals, how they're exercising, if it's becoming a little bit too rigid. And, you know, and eating disorders takes hold when these behaviors have happened consistently over time. You know, if someone restricts one day, that's not an eating disorder, right? It's when it happens consistently over time and it's impacting their mental and physical health. Right. Like it's in some ways taking labs for someone with anorexia when they get very low can be an indicator, but not always. Sometimes people's labs say very normal, even at the lowest of weights. So we can't just think that the physical aspect is the only thing we need to pay attention to. It's their thoughts. It's their behaviors. It's their sleep patterns. You know, it's like kind of looking at a holistic view.
Right.
And so then we also talked about orthorexia. So that is not a real eating disorder. It's kind of a coined eating disorder. But if for anyone who's not heard of that, that is an obsession with healthy eating. And you can see how this might be a little problematic in actually getting it to be a diagnosable eating disorder, because many of us are trying to eat healthier, right? And someone might say, well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with like eating as healthy as possible? And so it falls more along the anxiety spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. Of where someone becomes so compulsive about it and so obsessive about it that their food intake is very limited and they become very fearful. Even let's say a carrot, eating a carrot is going to turn into sugar and it's going to cause these symptoms. And I can't eat this, you know, food if I can't have any sugar, because X, Y, and Z will happen. And it just is an extremism around healthy eating. And I'm guessing, you know, for listeners, maybe there's someone they can think of that gets really extreme with their eating that way. And depending on the environment that you're in and the town that you live in, you may see more of that or less of that.
Jane, have you done anything with body dysmorphic disorder before? Is that popular?
Yeah, I see that. Absolutely. That is tied into, because when you think of like a diagnosis for eating disorders, there's a disturbance in the way in which someone sees their body weight or shape. And so there I've seen young girls, I mean, boys get eating disorders too, for sure. 25% of those with eating disorders are men, but at a very low weight, like, you know, 82 pounds, and they think that they need to lose weight. You're right. They look in the mirror, they see something different. And this is why it's so important to catch it early, because it, especially with anorexia, as weight is lost, like cognitive function is impaired. And, you know, their brain's ability to concentrate, see things accurately, right? They don't have the resources. They don't have the nutrition on board. And so they, their view is skewed. And so oftentimes if someone is a very low weight, they have to go into treatment just so they can start to weight restore. So they will be able to do therapy. They'll be able to understand what's going on because they're just so cognitively altered, but they don't see it, which is what's so frustrating.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay. So we've got some great information for parents. Now we're going to shift to coaches of young ones. So I've done my fair share of work in collegiate sport nutrition and still do, and work with a variety of sports. Some of those are very much aesthetic based. And we can say fortunately or unfortunately, because I do think there are some higher prevalence of things going on in those sports. But what I hear, like if I'm in meetings or practices or whatever, you know, I'm very astute into just listening about, you know, to the language that is being used with coaches and athletes, among coaches and assistant coaches, coaches and administrators. What, you know, when it comes to coaches, obviously the language that they use can be very sensitive and can be very direct, because obviously you take a young athlete, usually the coach is a role model and someone they look up to for the most part. I don't know if it's different how parents would go about this, but do you have any feedback or any, you know, tidbits for coaches who may work with young athletes in this space, you know, and really it's not even in the space, it's overall, but what tips do you have for coaches out there specifically with who are working with young athletes in that very, very kind of delicate environment?
Yeah. Well, one, I would encourage them to be mindful and observe, right? And be aware of the behaviors, the energy patterns, right? The performance of their athlete. And also to have perspective. Like I can imagine as a coach, right? You want to win, or you want your player to perform as the best that they can, you know, but this might only be a little section of this person's life, right? And they've got a whole life ahead of them, decades. And so, and people struggle with eating disorders for years and years and years. And 20% have what they call SEEDs, severe and enduring eating disorders, that last much, much longer, even a lifetime. I just had somebody who was 78 years old, still struggling with an eating disorder. And so just for coaches to weigh out like their athletes' mental health and emotional health and their life goals, like, you know, we want them to be healthy. We want them above their performance. And to just to balance that out. And because I'm imagining there's some coaches out there that might want to win at any cost. And what is the cost to their athlete? And so if that's not you as a coach, and you are sensitive to that, then it's really just about observing, getting to know your athlete, listening for those certain words around what they're eating, or I can't eat this, or I won't eat that, or I've got to go exercise more, or not paying attention to themselves, to their injuries, like letting themselves heal completely or as much as possible before they get back out there. And is it the coach that's pushing them to be out there sooner than they should be? Or is it the athlete? So just kind of taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture of this person as a whole, not just as the athlete.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I'm going to get on my soapbox really quick, Jane, and I would love for you to comment on this, because it's something that has bothered me my entire sport nutrition career. So, and specifically working like with collegiate athletes and professional athletes and stuff who have they have a professional team surrounding them, right? So they have strength coaches and physical therapists, athletic trainers, so on and so forth. And here's my soapbox. A lot of times we're grading these athletes based on the number on the scale, the number from the skin fold caliper, so body composition testing. And we're basically saying, you know, Jane, it doesn't look like you're really performing well because your body weight is up 2 pounds and your body fat percentage is up 1.6%. And all of a sudden, in my mind, that's destroying. That's a very destroying behavior. And I see where some of these professionals are coming from because it's their job to be very quantitative and very metric based. And, you know, a lot of times they keep their jobs by, you know, how they go about working with athletes. But, you know, I've had a lot of discussions with my colleagues in not as dietitians, but in the strength and conditioning world, and kind of just asking them politely, like, why are we still doing this? Like, what data are you getting or giving to these athletes when you're having that conversation regarding body weight, body composition versus sleep versus performance versus illness, immune system, gut health? And it's funny, I just want to say this, and again, here's where I'm going to have you comment. It's funny because a lot of times when I have these discussions, you see that proverbial light bulb go off and they're like, huh, you can just tell, like, you know, they're thinking, well, I've never really thought about that. I guess, right. You know, and most of the time they're doing what they're doing because it's always been done. And like, I like to challenge conventional wisdom, of course. So I would love to just hear your take on what's happening now, still happening nowadays with that.
Well, I guess when I hear you say that, I wonder, how is the athlete using that information?
Yes.
Like, I'm guessing that some of your athletes might use it and it might motivate them and there's no issue, right? And then there's others that will take that and will like sink it in deep and not feel good about themselves, feel like they're a failure. They can't believe they've gained 2 pounds. What's wrong with them? Where we know that weight fluctuates for all sorts of reasons that has nothing to do with their performance.
Yeah.
And so we're shining a spotlight on something that it doesn't show us the whole picture. And we're overemphasizing or we're magnifying this thing that then gets magnified in their brain. Right. And then other things get tied to it. Like, okay, now I've got to change my eating or I can't rest as much. I've got to, you know, push myself more or and I see you're shaking your head, like, right. It's more what that athlete does with that information. And that's why all of us are different. Right. And we have different ways of taking in information and processing it and different preconditions for anxiety, depression, ADHD. Right. And so I think we have to really know our athletes, but I think you asked a great question. Like, is this the framework that we want to work from in creating better performance?
And is it, in your opinion?
Well, I think there's a lot of room for, and as you say too, what you see, and it's always kind of bugged you.
Yeah.
It is like you're treading in that area where it could really be problematic and you're creating this environment and this focus that I don't think is totally accurate. Right.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I'll tell you, you know, to one of your points you just made, based on how the athlete uses that information regarding that, I can't remember the last time I remember an athlete using it as positive, to be honest with you. Even if they've adjusted or they've hit their goals, whatever they are, and I'm giving rabbit ears or air quotes to that because I don't know. It just, you know, kind of rubs me the wrong way, but I've always seen it more, you know, the athletes using it negatively, like, oh, you know, my body weight is up or on the flip side, I've only lost 1% body fat. But I was trying for 3 or coach wants me at 3. And all of a sudden they've got such positive progress and you're helping them and everything. And all of a sudden in their mind, they're a failure because they didn't hit that number. Right. So I have never seen this work out well at all.
No, it causes more shame for people. It causes more comparisons. It causes more of a striving to perfection, right? And we know that perfection is not possible. And so it sets up these really unrealistic expectations, I think, around our body. Like, obviously, as an athlete, we want to perform our best. We want to strive. But like, at what point does it become negative? And what point does it harm our athletes? And what point does it actually push them more into an eating disorder area? So yeah, I think you're right to bring it up. I think it can be problematic.
Yeah. Dina, I'm going to pass the baton to you in 1 second, but because I just keep going with this. I'm like, oh my gosh, everything you're saying, Jane. So there's a team I work with, and I won't mention this, but I've been working with them for quite a while. It's a collegiate team, and it's a female team. And I remember day one of my quote-unquote interview, if you will, with the coaches and the team, point blank, the coach stood up and said, okay, so what is your take on weighing our athletes and doing body composition on our athletes? And this is a very aesthetic-based female sport. And I was sweating. I'm like, oh my gosh, my response is going to make or break my ability to work with this team. But I said, listen, I've got to put it all out there, be very transparent. And I told them, everyone right there, I said, straight up, I said, I don't believe in body weight. I don't believe you have to weigh your athletes. I certainly don't believe you have to do body composition testing. And 5 years later, I'm happy to report I'm still working with this team. So
yay!
It just goes to show that we don't always need to follow conventional methods of doing things, because there are other ways of getting there.
And congratulations to you. Kudos to you to like stand up against an institution that says this is what you need to do, and say like, I don't think this is really great. And really the message that you sent to all those athletes.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And maybe I appreciate that.
The prevention of eating disorders that you did right there.
Right.
Jane, something you said early on in regards to parents and their children, like early intervention is key. I wondered if you could share briefly here some information about your new program specifically for parents of children that may have eating disorders, what that program entails.
Yes. So this last year in 2023, I spent the entire year developing a program, an online 8-week program that includes weekly Q&As that are groups for parents and about 50 different handouts. And I really poured in everything that I had learned and known in this field and everything I've seen at universities as a parent. So I am a parent of 4 kids. And when one of my kids went to college, she developed an eating disorder. And so all of a sudden I became the parent and not the provider. Mm. And I was like, okay, no one is helping parents out there. And they don't have enough information. They're doing things unintentionally. And I thought, okay, I have to do something to help these parents and to help these kids. And so I developed a program called the Eating Disorder Recovery Roadmap for Parents. It's on my website. There's an 8-minute video that I explain the program. And it's really to help kids, because when you look at, 95% of those with eating disorders are between the age of 12 and 25. So that's middle school, high school, college, right? And those years are also years that they're spending with their parents, many except for in college. And they're with their friends too, but their parents have a big influence on them. Even if the parents don't think they do, as teenagers push away, they still really do. So many of the kids I talk to want better relationships with their parents, want to talk to them, even when they're pushing them away. And so I realized that, parents really do play a very important pivotal role in helping kids recover. And my child who has an eating disorder is fully recovered and doing great. And so I learned so much through this process that I wanted to share that with parents. And so when I first started to create this, I interviewed lots of my different clients and I interviewed parents. And I asked them, for kids, what is the thing your parent does that is harmful? What do you wish your parent would do to help you? What do you wish your parent would never say? What is the thing, that's bugging you the most? And the same questions for parents, what is it that you need to help your child? And I put this all into the course. And so my goal is to really help parents learn how to be an ally with their child, because so much of the time you develop this contentious relationship around food and parents become kind of the food police. And I even know parents that with good intentions, God bless them, are following their kid around with a fork, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to get them to eat. And so it's just more that parents need to be educated on this difficult, complex issue that's pervasive, and given the tools and the strategies so they can learn to support their child. Because in the end, if their child has an eating disorder, it's going to be their child that needs to recover, right? Mm-hmm. Their parent can't force their child to recover. But the parent can certainly walk by their side they can, you know, be there to support them, to guide them, to just listen. It's amazing the impact that listening does, right? Like, listen more than you talk is one thing I'll tell parents. And so this is why I created this program, and I'd want to get it out there to all those parents of kids that age. And so it just was released a couple months ago, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, Jane, we're excited about it too. Yeah. We'll definitely put it in our show notes and, you know, spread the love, spread the word. It's an 8-week program. Like you said, is it, do you open it at certain times, or is it more of like an evergreen model? Okay.
Yep. It's ongoing. Each module is pre-recorded and live, and it's 60 to 90 minutes on all these different issues. And at the end, it's about how to create a roadmap. And I actually use a road, right? Like with different stops along the way of how they can help their child. And then there's a 9th module on eating disorders in college, because I had to do that since I worked at a university for so long.
Yeah.
And then the parents can get 4-month access to live weekly Q&As, where right now I've got parents from Maine and Ohio and New York and California, and we all get on and we talk about what's happening.
That is amazing. Such a needed resource. And obviously it's not Dina or I's specialty, but I've never heard of anything like this before. So kudos to you for developing that, and obviously near and dear to your heart, and you obviously being the specialist in this area makes a lot of sense to do that. So we'll definitely be able to, or definitely be sure to put that in our show notes. Is there, you know, we've been having such great conversation. I feel like we could go down so many different paths on our road. Anything else that you just want to mention that kind of highlights anything that we've already discussed, or something you're like, oh, you know what? I really need to make sure people hear this before we wrap it up.
I guess when you talk about eating disorder recovery, you know, it's really about people finding their way back to themselves. And I've seen this so much in my practice, is that when someone develops an eating disorder, they've really disconnected from themselves. They've disconnected from their hunger, from their fullness, from their desires, from their feelings, right? And they're using this as a way to cope. And so it's this journey in finding their way back to who they are, the value that they have, right? Inherently, their own unique gifts, right? The specialness about them. And that they are good enough. And so there's so much hope out there for parents that are worried, or other kids that are adults that have eating disorders that are worried, that moving towards recovery, and recovery isn't just a static point, right? It's this continuous journey, but moving towards there is an amazing journey of self-knowledge, self-discovery, that is really positive. And so if you're out there wondering, you know, should my child get help or should I get help? I would say, yes, you should, because living with an eating disorder robs you of your vitality in your life and your happiness in your life. And I've never seen anyone that is happier or does better in their life because they have an eating disorder, right? They do much worse. And so I would encourage people to get help, whatever that looks like, to move towards dealing with their eating disorder.
Beautiful. Jane, thank you so much for that. I know there's so many nuggets here in this conversation. And like Bob said, we could go down many other avenues. Yeah. And perhaps we'll ask you back to delve into a few other things in a future conversation. For right now, though, thank you again. We wanted to get to the last piece of our conversation with you, just getting to know a few more fun things about you with our high five segment. So if it's okay with you, we're just going to run 5 questions by you fairly quickly.
Okay.
And no pressure at all. I'll go ahead and start. Jane, so what is a favorite book or a movie that you could read over and over or watch repeatedly?
Oh my gosh. I love the movie and book Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love the self-discovery. I love the travel and just the vitality in that movie and the self-exploration.
On the eating topic, second question, what is your favorite dish to cook in the winter?
Oh, my gosh. In the winter? Yeah. I have so many favorite dishes. I do have a sweet tooth for sure. I like things like zucchini bread, banana bread. My kids and all my friends throughout my life have always teased me because I love jams and jellies. When I was little, I used to say, I'm going to open a place called Jane's Jams and Jellies.
That'd be awesome.
We still could do that.
I still could. I mean, I love breakfast. I love making like Belgian waffles and hot maple syrup and stews at night. And yeah, I like a lot of foods.
Excellent. Question number three, Jane, mountains, beaches, or deserts?
Okay. Maybe. Well, I am a Colorado girl. I grew up in the mountains, so I do love them. Although I lived in Boston for 8 years and so appreciate the ocean and the little villages right on the ocean. So I love the, and I went to school in the desert in Arizona. So I kind of lived.
Wow.
All of the above.
All of it. But I think being high up in the mountains is so much of what I grew up in with. So I do love that. But ocean's right there too.
Okay. Okay. Got it. Question number four. Do you, if you have one, do you have a normal nightly wind down routine? Like what's your pre-bedtime routine at night?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, if you would have asked me that, you know, 10 years ago when my four kids were all crazy at night, it would have been, what routine are you talking about? But now that they've moved out, right? I like to come home and we make dinner, my husband and I, and hang out. We might watch a show together. We play, I have a golden retriever that I love that we play with. Honestly, I end up talking to my kids a lot on the phone, like FaceTime. Mm. Because they now don't, three of them don't live in Colorado. So we're always catching up with what they're doing. And I try to meditate every day. Just kind of, it's a little bit more family and kid focused. I do try to not have TV going right until I go to sleep or computer or anything, like take time to relax. I usually have a cup of sleepy time with valerian tea every night before I go to bed. And I always read before I go to bed. Just because it helps me fall asleep and just try to have it be calm and peaceful.
Amazing. Yeah. I can relate to a lot of what you're saying, and the undigitizing part is so important, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Jane, last question here. If you had one piece of advice that you could give to any athlete out there, what would you have that piece of advice be?
To an athlete?
Yeah.
Or to in regards to their food or in regards to
anything at all that comes to mind?
Well, for athletes, I would say, make sure you enjoy your sport, right? I see so many people, whether they're more on the professional athlete or right, just recreational, sometimes they're not, they don't even enjoy what they're doing. Like they don't like running. They're running because they're supposed to, because that's helping them lose weight if it even does. Mm-hmm. But really, and just in your life too, like, you know, really take the time to know yourself and understand what it is you really love to do. What makes you feel passionate? So like what sports do you really love? And then if you do find that sport, make sure that you fuel yourself for that sport, right? Like some people are doing that sport for all sorts of other reasons, and you'll be able to continue to enjoy your sport more if you listen to your body, if you take care of your body while you're doing your sport. And you know, and that can also kind of go into other areas in our life. Again, that making sure that we listen to ourselves and what we want and what brings us happiness and joy.
Wise words, Jane. Gosh, we so appreciate your time and the resources that you have for parents and all of your other one-on-one services. We'll be sure to put your links and contact info in our show notes.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel like we could have talked on and on about so many more topics.
Oh, for sure. For sure. We'll have a part two and 16 and 33 later.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'd love it.
All right. Well, listeners, thank you so much for being here with us. And we will catch you on our next episode. We hope you enjoyed this episode, our conversation with Jane Reagan. Be sure to check out her website and connect with her. The links will be in our show notes, as well as to her program for parents. She does have a lot of services that she offers. So thanks so much, Jane, for joining us and for all of you for being here for this episode. Stay tuned for next week's episode. I am conversing with Bob about my recent knee surgery from a skiing accident and some of the things I was paying attention to nutritionally as I went into surgery and after surgery. So it is a brief conversation about some things, and we hope you will catch us for that one, episode 119. Remember, if you've got a sports nutrition question, we're always queuing those up for future Ask Us Anything episodes. You can send us an email to hello@insidesportsnutrition.com or head over to our website, insidesportsnutrition.com, and you'll see a link there to submit a question. If you have questions or are interested in the individual services that Bob and I both offer through our respective businesses, head over to Bob's website, energyperformance.com, energyperformance.com, or my company, nutritionmechanic.com, and you'll get to learn about the services and programs, testing services, and so on. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests involved and do not represent a replacement for medical consultation with your doctor. The information and opinions provided here are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or medical condition. This podcast is for information, education, and entertainment purposes only.